I'll be moderating today's webinar. If you're having problems logging onto the webinar via the Microsoft link, please call the 1-800 number for PTCC. This number is 1-800-363-7822. A reminder that you can also access a backup version of our presentation deck that was emailed to you yesterday to follow along with our webinar today. We are currently recording this webinar. Please be aware that we'll be posting this recorded webinar on the PTCC website in approximately a week. Okay, so for those of you logged onto the webinar today, you'll see the presentation deck on your right. On the left side of your screen, you'll see a chat box. The chat box is made public to everyone, so whatever you write will be posted and viewable by all those in the webinar, as well as to myself and our presenters today. During this webinar, we'll be taking questions at predefined times. During the presentation, feel free to enter any questions in the chat box. We will try to address as many questions during the Q&A sessions. So I'd like to welcome our three guest speakers from OTRU today. Before each of their presentations, I'll be providing a quick bio. So today we have Dr. Alexis Babayan, Jolene DeBray, and Dr. Merit Kirst. So welcome to the three of you. Okay, so to start us off today, I'd like to introduce Dr. Alexis Babayan. Dr. Babayan is a senior research associate with the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit. Dr. Babayan has considerable practical and methodological experience in conducting evaluation of tobacco control interventions, particularly in the area of smoking cessation. So, welcome, Alexi.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to today's webinar. Before we visit Dan, they provide, and then take a ride in the taxi, hopefully smoke-free taxi. I'm going to provide a brief overview of the work that we do at OTRU. And the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit is an academic research institution based at the University of Toronto, of University of Waterloo, and the Center for Addiction and Mental Health. We conduct research, monitoring, and evaluation in the area of tobacco control. Among our key activities are the evaluation of programs funded through the Smoke Free Ontario strategy, as well as the monitoring and evaluation of the strategy itself. Every year we produce a report called Strategy Evaluation Report, in which we analyze data from the population level surveys and from programs and services currently available in the province to document changes in tobacco control climate, including reach and effects of programs and policy initiatives, as well as tobacco control-related knowledge, attitudes, and behaviors. Another important area of OTRU's work is capacity building. OTRU is engaged in capacity building by providing teaching and training opportunities for students and health professionals. As you may know, OTRU runs an online training course, tobacco and public health from theory to practice, which provides a Canadian-focused overview of tobacco control knowledge, policy, and practice. This is a useful training tool for those who are willing to start working in the field, as well as those who are looking for updates of current facts or references. Knowledge exchange is another important area of OTRU's work. Knowledge exchange and translation is built in every research and evaluation project at OTRU to ensure that the findings are of optimal relevance to users. Knowledge exchange takes various forms, such as ongoing rapid response and scientific consulting for the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care, analysis and dissemination of science-based information to the stakeholders in the public health community through a variety of OTRU's publications, such as OTRU updates, OTRU special reports, strategy evaluation report, evaluation newsletters. OTRU is also engaged in providing sort of expert support to smoke-free Ontario's partners that are evaluating their own programs and initiatives. There's key principles that have been guiding the development and implementation of research and evaluation projects at OTRU. First of all, our approach is a realist evaluation approach, premised on the understanding that every intervention, every program works differently in different contexts. Program managers, policymakers need to know not only whether an effect can be observed, but also how and why programs are working or not working. To better inform practice, evaluation needs to establish a relationship between the program intervention mechanisms, the context in which the program is being implemented, and the expected outcomes. This is a useful approach both at earlier stages of program implementation as well as later stages. When program matures, when the program matures, it's a useful approach to draw conclusions about what works best for whom and for which subpopulations and under what contexts. We also implement a utilization-focused evaluation, meaning that we are not only guided by our own research and evaluation interests when we do research, but we also aim to support the use of research and evaluation evidence to make changes and improve the practice. So for every of our project, we identify our primary audience, our intended users, our stakeholders, and we support their decisions about future programming policies by providing them with evidence-based information about how programs and policies are working and whether they are having impact. Our approach is a participatory approach, meaning that we engage program managers, stakeholders, recipients in every aspect of building and implementing a research or evaluation framework. Last but not least is we try to employ a mixed method approach. Our experience shows that synthesizing information from multiple sources of data, including surveys, program administrative data, qualitative inquiry, interviews, focus groups, is a useful approach to better understand how programs work, changes occurring over time at the program level, at the individual level, as well as to get to those contextual factors that may explain the barriers and facilitators to successful program implementation. Due to time limits, I'm going just to walk you through just a few of the most recently completed and currently underway the projects in the area of cessation. So here's a list of the projects. We do studies of subpopulations, especially those with a high prevalence of smoking in the general population, such as young adults, smokers with low socioeconomic status, pregnant, postpartum women. We examine to what extent the cessation needs of these subpopulations are being met within the existing services and programs available in the province. The idea is to identify gaps and describe those gaps between the existing services and desired cessation services and programs in order to provide information necessary for building a more comprehensive cessation system in the province. We recently completed a survey of Ontario hospitals just to provide a snapshot of hospital-based services, policies, and practices. This was a survey to inform the ministry's initiative to enhance cessation services to hospitalized smokers in the province. We recently completed a study of cessation billing codes. As you may know, the Ontario government introduced specifically cessation-related billing codes for physicians and general practitioners in order to encourage the provision of cessation services at the primary care level. So we conducted a study to examine To what extent actually those the physicians in Ontario are actually using those billing codes to provide cessation services? Survey of dental professionals, so we'll be presented in a minute. Another study that we are currently in progress is the STOP with family health teams and community health centers. It's a collaborative project with the CAMH team. It's a formative evaluation which examines the program implementation to validate that program activities are implemented as planned, and we also explore the variations in program implementation across participating family health teams and community health centers. This is an ongoing evaluation which aims to inform adjustments and improvements in the program as it evolves. The cessation pathway project is another currently underway project that to examine smokers' experience with existing cessation services and to identify opportunities to strengthen the linkages between the services and programs available in the province. As I mentioned in the very beginning, we do evaluation of programs funded through the Smoke Free Ontario strategy, and the last two projects mentioned in the list are the RNA Best Practice Smoke Cessation Initiative and the Ontario Lung Association's Quit and Get Fit Initiative, which we've been evaluating in the past couple of years already. So this is just an overview of the project in the cessation. For more information about our projects, not only in cessation but also in prevention and protection, please visit our website and newly redesigned our website at www.otru.org. So you can familiarize yourself with what is the current the current work that we do, as well as the research questions and the methods that they employ. So I'm going to stop here and invite my colleague Julian DeBrace, who is going to present some of the key findings from the study of dental professionals.
Thank you, Alexi. I just thought before we move on to Jolene, we just have one quick question that's been asked. Participants are wondering where they can get a copy of the surveys of the Ontario Hospitals and Dental Professionals, or where they can access these reports.
Oh, this report is posted at OTRU's website. You can find it, I think, under the association section. Is that correct? Yeah. Under the publications, sir. Okay. So the report is available. No, the survey of hospitals. Hospitals, yeah, that's what.
Okay, thanks a lot. Okay, so I'd like to welcome our second guest presenter, Jolene DeBray. Jolene obtained her Master's of Science in Community Health and Epidemiology from Dalhousie University. At OTRU, Jolene has coordinated several evaluations related to the implementation and enforcement of the SFOA, provided statistical support to OTRU's TIMS and strategy evaluation reports, and conducted assessments of the level of smoking cessation services provided by Ontario's hospitals and dental health professionals. So welcome, Jolene.
Thank you. So as Alexa has introduced, we will be presenting the dental health survey results, specifically the provision of smoking cessation services by Ontario dental professionals. So the purpose of the study was to explore the experience of Ontario dental professionals in providing brief smoking cessation intervention services, specifically the 5As, as part of routine dental practice. For those of you that may not be familiar, the 5As include ask, advise, assess, assist, and arrange follow-up. And we'll get into a little bit more about that later on. For this study, we collected information from dental professionals through an online survey and one-on-one telephone interviews. The online survey was conducted last year, November-December. All members of the Ontario Dental Association, Ontario Dental Hygienists Association, and Ontario Dental Assistants Association were invited to participate in the online survey. We estimate that was approximately about 22,000 dental professionals. So in total, we had 1,966 dental professionals complete the survey. We also conducted telephone interviews earlier this year in February-March with a small subsample of online survey respondents to further explore the provision of smoking cessation in routine practice. Findings from both the interviews and online survey were similar, therefore the remainder of the presentation will focus on the findings from the online survey. So here's a quick look at the demographics of the online survey respondents. As you can see here, the majority of the respondents were female, about 93%. Over half the survey respondents were between the ages of 30 and 49 years. Correspondingly, the median number of years practiced in their dental profession was about 13.8 years. Dental assistants comprised two-thirds of the online survey respondents at 67%, followed by dental hygienists at 22% and dentists at 11%. Close to 90% of respondents worked in a private practice setting. 5% worked in public health settings, while the remaining 6% worked in other practice settings such as hospital, community health center, regulatory college, and long-term care facilities. So first, I'll present the findings about smoking cessation training. Overall, 21.4% of respondents reported that they had received smoking cessation training.
Okay, so we'd now like to provide participants on the webinar today the opportunity to participate in a poll. So after Jolene reads the questions, there'll be an opportunity for all of you to vote. And to vote, you simply just click on the circle beside each of the options.
Okay, so for our first poll, please select which dental professional group you believe was most likely to have received formal smoking cessation training. Was it dentists, dental hygienists, or dental assistants?
Okay, so we've now opened the poll, so you're, there you go.
Okay, most of you guessed correctly. If we can flip to the next slide. So for the results, about 46% of dental hygienists had received smoking cessation training, which was more than dentists or dental assistants. So you guessed correctly, very good. Here are the main sources of smoking cessation training as selected by survey respondents. The most common sources were university and college curriculum at 38%, public health units such as the You Can Make It Happen campaign at 28%, professional associations at 19%, and the clinical tobacco intervention at 17%. And the main reasons for not receiving smoking cessation training, as reported by survey respondents, was lack of awareness of available training at 54%. Other less common reasons included lack of time, lack of funding, no interest in receiving training, no need for training, and lack of training in the geographic area. So next, I'll present findings regarding smoking cessation practices and services. In terms of smoking cessation practices, 76% of survey respondents routinely record smoking status in patient charts. Smoking cessation pamphlets were available in 44% of respondents' offices, while smoking-related posters were displayed in 25% of respondents' offices. Only 10% of respondents routinely flagged files of patients who smoke for advice.
Okay, so we're going to have another poll. So again, after Jolene reads the question, you'll be able to vote.
So before I present the findings from the smoking cessation services, here's poll number two. Please select which percentage of dental professionals you believe ask all or most of their patients about their smoking status. Is it 20, 40, 60, or 80%?
So the poll is open. You can vote now. Okay, so we're just going to give you a few more seconds to vote.
Okay. Again, this group is very sharp this morning. So the answer to the poll, if we get to the next slide. Thank you. So the answer to the poll is about 41% of survey respondents ask all or more of their patients about their smoking status. So very good. Other smoking cessation services included 34% of respondents advise all or most of their patients who smoke to stop smoking. 26% of respondents assess all or most of their patients' readiness to quit smoking. Fewer survey respondents provided one of the assist smoking cessation services, such as 12% offered all or most patients who smoke self-help resources, 10% recommended nicotine replacement therapy to all or most patients who smoke, and 11% referred all or most patients who smoke to external resources. Last, about 5.5% of respondents arranged follow-up with all or most of their patients who smoke. Here are the results for the provision of smoking cessation services by dental profession groups. The highlighted cells show the smoking cessation service where both dentists and dental hygienists reported similar levels of providing the service, and where both dentists and dental hygienists reported significantly higher levels of service provision compared to dental assistants. So these smoking cessation services included asking patients about their smoking status, advising patients to stop smoking, and referring patients to external resources. Again, here are the results for the provision of smoking cessation services by dental profession groups. This time, the highlighted cells show the smoking cessation services where dental hygienists reported the highest levels of providing the services compared to dentists and dental assistants. These smoking cessation services included assessing patients' readiness to quit smoking, offer self-help resources, recommending NRT, and arranging follow-up. So next, I'll present the findings for service facilitator. From the list of smoking cessation service facilitators, survey respondents identified patient interest in discussing quitting as the most common facilitator at 83%. Other common service facilitators included training or knowledge in tobacco use cessation at 58%, having patient self-help materials readily available at 55%, access to external resources at 38%, and collaboration amongst dental staff and provision of smoking cessation services at 33%. By profession, more dental hygienists selected patient interest in discussing quitting, training, or knowledge in tobacco use cessation, availability of patient self-help materials, and access to external resources as service facilitators compared to dentists and dental assistants. More dentists selected reimbursement for smoking cessation services as a service facilitator compared to dental assistants and dental hygienists. Next, I will present findings about service barriers.
Okay, so we're going to have our last poll for Jolene's presentation. So again, we'll open the poll after Jolene reads the question.
So please select which barrier you believe is the greatest barrier to providing smoking cessation services to patients. Is it lack of reimbursement, lack of time with patients, fear of alienating patients, or patients not interested in discussing quitting?
Okay, so we're going to open the poll, so you can vote now. Just give you a few more seconds.
Okay, this one was a bit trickier, I guess. The result for the poll, we get back to the slide. There are all good reasons for being barriers, but from the list of smoking cessation service barriers, survey respondents identified patient interest in discussing quitting as the most common barrier at 73%. Other common service barriers included lack of time with patients, which was 58%, fear of alienating patients at 48%, lack of training or knowledge of tobacco use cessation at 45%, lack of patient self-help materials at 36%, and lack of awareness of cessation resources and community services at 33%. So by profession, dentists encountered fewer barriers in general compared to dental hygienists and dental assistants. More dental hygienists stated that lack of time with patients was a barrier compared to dentists and dental assistants. More dentists stated that lack of reimbursement was a barrier compared to dental hygienists and dental assistants. So the last section of survey findings I will present are the resources to assist smoking cessation service delivery. 50% of more of survey respondents reported that any of these resources would be very helpful in improving smoking cessation service provision, including self-help materials, in-person training with continuing education credits, referral forms to Smokers Helpline or similar community cessation resources, conference sessions with continuing education credits, online learning modules, and a flowchart or introductory scripts on how to do brief smoking cessation counseling. So before I present a summary of the findings, we must consider the limitations to the study. Both of our online survey and one-on-one telephone interviews employed a convenient sample recruitment strategy. We received a low response rate to the online survey, only about 9% of all participants who were invited to do the survey completed it. Last, all findings are based on self-report and were not verified to assess the validity of the responses. So for these reasons, the findings of the study should be interpreted with caution and cannot be generalized to all dental professionals currently practicing in Ontario. So now for the summary of findings. In summary, our study found that not many dental professionals routinely provide brief smoking cessation intervention services. More dental hygienists than dentists or dental assistants have training and provide cessation services. And perceived patient interest in quitting or lack of it is a critical factor for providing smoking cessation services. Our findings show that improving dental professionals' knowledge and skills is critical. More outreach and dissemination activities are needed to increase awareness of training programs, cessation services, and resources. So in closing, I'd just like to acknowledge that the study was funded by the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care Health Promotion Division, and we have special thanks for assistance in recruiting survey participants from the three dental professional associations.
Thank you very much, Jolene. So we now have time for questions for Jolene, or if you have questions for Alexi. If you would like to, I encourage you to ask questions over the phone. So to unmute your line, you'll have to press star 6. If you'd prefer to ask questions through the chat box, please ask away. We have a few coming in through the chat box now. Jolene, you must have done an excellent job of covering all your results. So the first comment, very comprehensive summary of findings. No need for questions. Thanks.
Thanks, Janice.
There you go. Okay, so we have a question. A group is wondering if you have an explanation of why 82% indicated that patient interest in smoking cessation was a facilitator, and yet 72% indicated this was a barrier.
That's a very good question, which is why we've identified it as a critical point.
It's very interesting to see this. Patient interest is identified as a facilitator and as a barrier, which suggests that this is a very critical factor in determining whether dental professionals are going to provide cessation services or not. But what is important is that when we look at the population level trends, that we see that the overall intentions to quit among the smokers are pretty high. 60% are willing to quit in the next 6 months, and I think about 25% at least intend to quit in the next 30 days. So there, we potentially what we see here is those perceptions need to be addressed by educating dental professionals about the current trends in intentions, in smokers' intentions to quit. So in reality, smokers are willing actually to make a quit attempt. They intend to quit. About a quarter of them intend to quit in the next 30 days. And this is something that should be communicated to dental professionals to address, just to address their perceived barriers.
Thanks. Our next question is, was there a difference in responses of dental hygienists who have their own practice versus working with dentists?
So we did do some analysis by private practice versus public health, but not down to the level of dental health profession. So I can't comment on that specifically. There were some differences between private practice mm-hmm. and public health, but I'm sorry, I didn't bring that with me. Maybe I can follow up.
But in general, we can say that those working in the public health settings are doing better in terms of providing cessation services rather than those working in private practice. And through interviews with a subsample of survey respondents, we learned that why is that? And we learned that those working in public health settings, especially dental hygienists, they have access to other resources available within the public health unit. They can refer their patients to other to their colleagues, nurses, and other health practitioners for further cessation support. So this may explain why those working in public health settings are more actively engaged in providing cessation services compared to those working in private settings.
Okay, thanks. Our next question is regarding the lack of interest in quitting. Mark is wondering if this is based on just a perception, or did the dental professionals ask patients about quitting and then find the patients were not interested in discussing this?
Because this was a survey, and based on survey questions, we don't have any sense of what order mm-hmm. Things were done. So strictly based on the survey question, so I guess it is probably just their perception at the time of filling out the survey.
Yeah, this is a perception. But the thing is that those perceptions are actually driving them determining whether they are willing to provide cessation services or not. So this is, as I mentioned a bit earlier, this is what needs to be addressed by through educating dental professionals in about the current trends in intentions and quit attempts among smokers.
We have a comment too by Cynthia. I don't know if you wanted to have any additional comments on what she has said. So she said that she finds it interesting to see such a high percentage of perceived patients not interested. Perhaps this is just perceived. I find in my own work in different venues in public health that people want to and like to talk about their smoking.
Yeah, definitely. And as I said, this may have to do with the practice setting, the type of setting. So as we noticed, we found through the interviews and the survey that those working in public health settings are more actively engaged and they are less likely to see this as a barrier, their lack of interest.
We have another follow-up to a question. So Sonica says, I wonder why the respondents in public health settings were lower than the ones working in private practice.
I guess in terms of patient interest.
Yes, sorry. Yes.
Why? Can you find the answer? Why?
Sonica, if you want to unmute your phone, if you could push star six.
Yeah, can
if you could just,
that,
yeah, if you could just maybe.
More detail.
Yeah. So she says of the initial respondents. Yes. Sonica? So to unmute your phone, you just need to push star six.
You have it for finance?
I'll have it by public health.
Yeah, first of all, we don't have the there are more findings in the survey that we actually presented today. We can follow up after this presentation.
Sonica, if you want to send either Alexa or myself an email with a question, and we can look into it more.
Yeah, in general, but in our sample of dental professionals who completed this survey, we had only, I mean, there was a low, smaller percentage of dental professionals who reported working in the public health. This is for sure. The majority, I mean, this is obvious, but the majority of them work in private practice. But we can definitely follow up on this and provide more detail. And then this report, actually those findings are not yet available on our OTRU's website because we just submitted this for publication and we're just waiting for the decision. Once it's accepted, hopefully, we can certainly post it on our website.
Great. So we still have a few minutes if anyone has any additional questions.
The conference has been unmuted.
Mark, did you want to try to answer your or to ask your question? We've unmuted the lines. If you do have a question, you can go ahead and ask.
Yeah, we typed the answer question in earlier, but I just typed that to let you know that that was probably why other people weren't able to respond.
Oh, okay. Thanks a lot. Okay, so if there's no additional questions, Alexi and Jolene, welcome. If you have additional questions that you think of later, please.
The conference has been muted.
Please feel free to email them. As well, there'll be time at the end of the webinar. If you think of additional questions for the two of them, you can always ask then. So I'd like to welcome our third and last presenter today, Dr. Mark Kirst. Dr. Kirst is a research associate and co-head of the Population Research Initiative in Mental Health and Addictions at OTRU. She is also an assistant professor in the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto. So welcome, Marit. And I just wanted to remind participants that we have muted the lines again. So if you have questions throughout, please type them in the chat box or hold them until the Q&A. Okay?
Thanks, Sophia. It's great to be here. So today I'm going to be presenting, so we're going to move from the pillar of cessation and we're going to move over to the tobacco control pillar of protection and enforcement. And this study was specifically looking at the problem of smoking in taxis and how to develop more effective approaches to enforcement to address issues such as this. So in the presentation, I'm going to give just a very brief introduction to the risk-based enforcement pilots, which is the sort of umbrella project that this particular pilot falls under, and the problem-solving community engagement approach, which was the approach that was the that guided the particular study. The study has two components. It's a multi-stage project, and the first stage was the problem definition stage, where we looked at sort of defining more clearly what the problem of smoking in taxis was. And the second stage involved a formative evaluation of an intervention that was developed to address the problem of smoking in taxis. And then I'll talk about general learning that we can take away from this project. So the risk-based enforcement pilot project objectives were to explore new approaches to enforcement by working with participating public health units to tailor and pilot evidence-informed approaches to enforcement, with which to reduce the risk of non-compliance with the Smoke-Free Ontario Act through implementation of resource-effective interventions, monitoring, and analysis. And this project was developed through a request from the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care, specifically the Health Promotion Division. And the particular project that I'm going to talk about today was guided by Sparrow's problem-solving approach to problems with enforcement of regulatory policies. And the problem-solving approach has a number of phases. So first, you are to nominate a particular problem with respect to enforcement, then further define the problem, subsequently determine how to measure impact if one were to intervene to address the problem, then develop an intervention plan with which to address the problem, implement the intervention and monitor and evaluate the intervention, and then essentially close the project and hopefully you've successfully addressed your problem. So given that we were working very closely with the ministry and a participating public health unit on this project, we've called the project generally problem-solving community engagement approach because, again, we're engaging with the community. The community, through the participating public health unit, identified the problem. We're nominated the problem in partnership with us. And specifically, the participating public health unit was interested in the particular setting of workplace vehicles and noncompliance to the SFOA in workplace vehicles. Specifically, the focus was then narrowed to taxi vehicles. As part of the problem definition stage, that was, as you remember from the last figure, is the first step in Sparrow's problem-solving approach, we employed a mixed methods design to further define the problem. And then subsequently, the findings of this problem definition stage were to inform the development of an intervention to address noncompliance with the SFOA and taxis. And then after that intervention was to be implemented, OTRU was then to evaluate the intervention that was to be developed by the participating public health unit. So first I'm going to speak to and present findings and methods on the problem definition stage. So as I mentioned, we used a mixed methods approach to data collection. And first of all, we assessed surface nicotine levels in taxis to assess the evidence of smoking. Specifically, this was a measure of third-hand smoke. So we did the surface nicotine level wipe protocol in a sample of 42 taxis in the participating public health unit city, and we adapted a standardized analysis protocol that was developed by researchers in California. This is a cutting-edge protocol. And specifically, the reason why we used this approach was that research has shown that nicotine from specifically third-hand smoke can react with indoor pollutants and resulting in the formation of tobacco-specific nitrosamines, and that there is no safe level of exposure to third-hand smoke. And there's also evidence that third-hand smoke can become more toxic over time. So it was important to measure these levels of third-hand smoke within taxis because they're enclosed spaces, and they serve a public function, but also they're workplaces for drivers. So that was the first stage of the problem definition stage. Then we wanted to get perceptions to the problem from taxi passengers. So we did street interviews with local taxi passengers. And then we also wanted to get perceptions from the taxi industry as to the nature and extent of the problem. So we did focus groups with taxi drivers and key informant interviews with taxi administration representatives. So I'm now just going to move on to talk about the findings from the problem definition stage. But before I do, we're going to do a quick poll.
Okay, so again, you'll be able to vote after Mart reads the question. So the poll is closed right now.
Okay, so, all right. People are excited about this question. So reflecting some of the questions that we asked some taxi passengers were asking you, whether you've seen anyone smoking in a taxi or smell smoke during a taxi ride, and people have voted. We'll give you a few more minutes to vote.
So I think some of you might not be able to see this on your screen. I think we've had a few messages. So, Mart, if you could maybe just summarize what's come in.
Sure. So we've asked folks, have you ever seen someone smoking in a taxi or smelled smoke during a taxi ride? And 83% of people have said yes. Okay, and so basically we've found evidence that smoking does occur in taxis. So this figure reflects nicotine levels that were observed through our surface nicotine level protocol. We also administered an observational checklist to assess whether there's physical evidence of smoking. So we measured whether there was evidence such as ashes, dust, an odor in the vehicle, and through that measure we split the sample as to whether there was physical evidence of smoking having occurred within the vehicle, and 60% of the vehicles that we sampled, which was about 10% of the taxi fleet in this particular city, could be characterized as having physical evidence of smoking having occurred in the vehicle. And then not surprisingly, with respect to nicotine levels, the median nicotine level was highest in these vehicles that we found physical evidence of smoking in. And so 90% of the participating vehicles had a surface nicotine level exceeding the mean surface level that was reported by those researchers that I mentioned in California, who had conducted a similar study looking at nicotine levels in used cars for sale. But the mean level of nicotine that they found in their vehicles was 8 micrograms per square meter. So the mean level in the vehicles where we found physical evidence of smoking in our vehicles was 664 micrograms per square meter. So that's quite a bit higher than what was found by the researchers in California. We think that there are definitely, you know, climate-related issues that would lend to these differences, but still we've found very high levels of nicotine within the vehicles that we sampled. So then moving to the passenger beliefs about smoking in taxis, we asked people whether they felt that smoking in taxis was a problem, and when participants were asked whether it was a problem, the majority indicated that smoking in taxis was somewhat or definitely a problem among both drivers and passengers. We also asked passengers whether they had actually experienced smoking in taxis in the last year, so not unlike the question that we asked you. And we found that 32% had seen a driver smoke in a taxi, and 37% had seen a passenger smoking in a taxi in the last year. We also asked passengers whether they felt that smoking should be allowed in taxis, and we stratified the sample by smoking smoker and non-smoker status, and we found that the majority of respondents, regardless of smoker status, felt that taxis should not, or smoking should not be allowed in taxis, but more non-smokers than smokers agreed that smoking should not be allowed. So through our work, we also talked with drivers to get a sense of what some of the barriers and facilitators were with achieving a smoke-free taxi. And we heard that there are a number of barriers and challenges to doing this for drivers. They A number talked about encountering non-compliant passengers, people who were very determined to smoke within the taxi. And one driver talked specifically about an incident where he picked up some young girls and they insisted on smoking and actually pulled out a knife and cut the seatbelt in the car when he asked them not to smoke. Drivers also talked about limitations to tobacco enforcement, specifically in the evening shift, when obviously enforcement officers are not out in the community to enforce. So the night shift seemed to be a difficult time for enforcing the policy. Another barrier was driver concern over losing fares if they were to refuse a passenger who wanted to smoke in the taxi. And a number of drivers said that they had actually had that experience when passengers had just moved on to another taxi when they refused. A number of drivers felt that they themselves had the right to smoke and that passengers also have the right to smoke, and it's not appropriate for someone to indicate that they don't have that right. With respect to facilitators to achieving a smoke-free taxi, drivers talked about the fact that the stickers that are placed within vehicles are effective and do raise SFOA awareness, that ongoing enforcement of the SFOA is very important, and some also talked about using conflict resolution strategies when encountering a passenger who wants to smoke. For example, this driver talked about, you know, seeing a passenger walking towards their cab, they would tell them, go ahead, finish your cigarette, and I won't start the meter. So in summary, with respect to our findings from the problem definition stage, we found that, in fact, smoking in taxis is a problem. Through the perceptions, and I think this you resonated this as well through your poll, we found that drivers supported public health messages and campaigns and tools that prevent and reduce smoking in taxis. We heard that drivers encounter a number of challenges with respect to non-compliant passengers, thoughts and feelings of smokers' rights and loss of fares, and also facilitators to achieving a smoke-free environment in their workplace. For example, fines, they felt that enforcement, ongoing enforcement of the SFOA through fines was important, the stickers within vehicles, and then the tension reduction strategies that I mentioned as well. So moving on to the second stage of the study, which was the evaluation of the intervention that was to be developed by the public health unit in response to our findings. So we shared the findings from the problem definition phase with a participating public health unit, and they developed an intervention, which involved a health promotion campaign to raise awareness of the issue, the SFOA legislation, and the related $305 fine for smoking in taxis among passengers and drivers. And the intervention began being implemented in the community in December 2011. The public health unit had actually intended on providing also some, in addition to the health promotion campaign, providing cessation support to drivers, but unfortunately that plan didn't pan out due to capacity issues in their clinic. So just a brief description of the health promotion SFOA awareness campaign that the public health unit implemented. Posters were provided and posted in a number of locations in cities, for example, grocery stores, malls, places where people would be most likely to take taxis. In-taxi business cards and rear-facing in-taxi promotional sleeves were posted through participating taxi companies in the community. And the caption on these materials said, "Butt out before you get in, all taxis must be smoke-free, steer clear of a $305 fine." And this was the image that was on the card. So as I mentioned before, as part of the project, OTRU was to conduct an evaluation of the campaign. Unfortunately, the development phase for the intervention that the public health unit developed suffered a number of challenges, which I'll talk about in a moment. So that delayed the ability to begin an evaluation until March 2012. And the campaign was actually ongoing at the time of evaluation, so that's an important thing to keep in mind. So the evaluation only captured preliminary assessments of campaign implementation and reach. So findings need to be interpreted with caution in that sense. So the evaluation question that guided our evaluation, so again, this was a formative evaluation because the implementation of the campaign was ongoing. We looked at what aspects of the campaign implementation are working well, what are the challenges in achieving campaign goals and implementing, and what is the preliminary reach of the campaign to target populations, for example, taxi passengers and drivers. Again, as part of data collection for the formative evaluation phase, we used a mixed methods design. We conducted street intercept interviews with local taxi passengers and drivers, street intercept surveys. We did focus groups with taxi drivers, and we conducted key informant interviews with public health unit staff and taxi administration. So I'll now talk about the results from the formative evaluation of the health promotion campaign. And because we have a lot of findings, I'm just going to focus on the qualitative data that we gathered as part of this evaluation, specifically from the focus groups with drivers who were implementing the campaign and the key informant interviews with public health unit staff and taxi administration as to how the campaign was implemented. So as I mentioned before, we heard that a number of challenges to campaign development and implementation were encountered by the public health unit team who was in charge of developing and implementing distributing the campaign materials. So they experienced some staffing challenges over the time of the campaign development and rollout. It was perceived that limited funding was a big problem for the campaign, and also limited communication with the funder about actual funds was an issue. For example, this person is talking about how they didn't have a dedicated account line, so they essentially, they wanted to do a number of different things, including paid media and radio ads for the purpose of the campaign, but unfortunately it just wasn't feasible because of their budget, and it was hard to engage the funder about some of these decisions. Again, because of some of the challenges that I mentioned before, limited consultation with campaign partners, for example, the taxi industry, occurred in the sense that the industry, for example, administration and drivers were not consulted very much about the design of the campaign and how the materials were to be distributed. And as a result, this led to challenges with campaign material distribution. And as a result, all of these challenges shifted timelines quite a bit for implementation of the campaign, which greatly impacted the timelines and feasibility of the formative evaluation as well. We also heard from interviewees that the main facilitator to campaign development implementation was the development of internal cross-program partnerships within the public health unit. Because of some of the staffing challenges that they encountered, they were able to pull from other departments to get some resourcing that they needed in order to get the campaign up and running. But also external partnerships. So while unfortunately the taxi industry was not sort of engaged in depth in the development of the design, it was generally viewed as a step in the right direction to start engaging these types of partners. For example, this person is saying, it's been a very positive development because the taxi industry, knows we're eager to assist and want to work towards compliance in their vehicles. So I think that's been a good development. Due to many of the challenges that I mentioned before, at the time of the evaluation that we were conducting, campaign reach to both taxi passengers and drivers was relatively low. But those passengers who were aware of the campaign that we talked to through the street intercept surveys found that the posters specifically that were posted in community locations were helpful for raising awareness of the issue and the fine. They didn't think that the business cards and the promotional sleeves in the taxis were terribly helpful, though, for raising awareness. But anecdotally, a number of the passenger survey participants noted that they previously weren't aware of the $305 fine for smoking in taxis. With respect to retail perceptions of the campaign among drivers, again, you know, reach was a little, was relatively low among drivers. A number hadn't actually received the materials or knew what to do with them. But essentially, those who were aware of the campaign felt that the materials were somewhat or not helpful for raising awareness of the issue, but that they were helpful specifically for raising awareness of the fine itself. So over to some of the more in-depth perceptions of the campaign that we heard through focus groups and interviews with taxi drivers and administration. Drivers were generally receptive to the idea of a public awareness campaign, yet they identified that a number of challenges were encountered. For example, they felt they didn't receive clear instructions as to what to do with some of the campaign materials, because essentially they were the implementers. They were to hand out business cards to passengers in the taxi and to refer to the sleeve to indicate that this was a no smoking was allowed in the vehicle. Some of the drivers expressed safety concerns specifically about the promotional sleeves. They felt that the strap that fastened the sleeve to the back of the seat in the taxi was too long and that someone could use this to as a weapon. They reported that the passengers were not terribly receptive to the materials being handed out to them. This driver spoke of handing out a number of business cards to passengers and that they would just sort of throw them back or leave them inside the taxi and not really, you know, sort of retain the message. But he felt that even if they throw them at him, that people were still getting the message that the vehicle was smoke-free. Also, some drivers were confused by the image on the campaign in the sense that the steering wheel, they felt that the steering wheel image targeted the driver as opposed to the passenger, which we've seen, it's not just an issue of one particular group smoking in the vehicle, it can be drivers and passengers who are smoking in the vehicle. So generally, what can we take away from this study for future development of problem-solving community engagement projects? While the findings are very specific to the one setting of taxi vehicles, there's a number of general findings about how the overall approach worked. So generally, it was found that the problem-solving community engagement approach was useful for engaging relevant partners and beginning a dialogue and generating learning about this particular issue with non-compliance to the SFOA. Specific learnings that were generated for the development of future health promotion campaigns along the same lines or problem-solving community engagement pilots include that consultations with the key audience are key, specifically in this case, the implementers of the campaign should have been consulted in greater depth to further test and promote effectively the campaign materials. Following this, instruction to the target audience on how to distribute through an educational workshop is necessary in future projects, as well as consultation on design. We also learned the importance of sufficient funding and linkages with the funder and other tobacco control programs to support intervention development. Cross-program collaboration was viewed as very important in light of issues with funding and staffing challenges, and also linkages with funder to kind of reinforce sufficient resourcing is also key in these types of projects. Another learning that was very, very important that we all learned was that these types of projects require flexible timelines. especially with respect to the fact that this was very multi-staged in the sense that we had the first problem definition stage, then the intervention development phase that the public health unit was to do, and then subsequently an evaluation. It really wasn't feasible within the timeline that we were given, especially the number of challenges that were encountered with the project to do all of these and meet the very rigid timelines. So flexible timelines are very important in this kind of a problem-solving community engagement project. Okay, so that was it for our findings from this multi-staged project. And I'd just like to acknowledge funding from the Ontario Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care, the Health Promotion Division, the participating Public Health Unit Tobacco Control Program staff, and a number of other staff that supported us with data collection and analysis.
Okay, thank you very much, Marit. So now we have some time for questions. So we are going to unmute the lines for you. So please feel free to ask your questions orally, or if you're more comfortable typing them in the chat box, feel free to do that. We did have one question come through during your presentation, Marit, and an individual is wondering if you're able to share who the public health unit was involved in this project.
At the time, we're not going to share the name of the public health unit, but we're discussing with them as to a wider knowledge translation plan. So that's a question that we can explore further.
Great, thanks.
The conference has been unmuted.
And during this time, if you also have questions for Alexi or Jolene, please feel free to ask them questions now as well. Okay, so we have a question that's come in. So someone's wondering what size of a city was this project completed in and how many taxis in total do they have?
That is a really great question. So it is an urban city. I don't have the exact population off the top of my head. But the taxi, there's two participating or two taxi companies in the city, and we were only able to sample about 10% of that taxi fleet. But I don't have exactly the exact number of taxis in that community, unfortunately, in my brain.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so we have another question. Did you speak with or survey any of the local enforcement officers to get their perspective on the issue and number of charges being laid?
Yes, so we did speak with them. Again, I don't have the specific number of charges being laid, but they did view it as a problem and that they were involved in the problem identification stage of the project. So they were very much participating in those discussions that identified this problem that needed to be addressed through this project.
Okay. Janice notes that you said that the ministry had asked you to do the study. Do you know if there are any plans to roll out the pilot across the province?
I don't know for sure, but I think that there's interest in exploring the problem-solving community engagement approach. I think it has this in the sense that it can engage a number of different partners in identifying problems. It's something that I think is being explored, but I don't know the status of whether it's going to be rolled out.
Okay. Don is wondering if the promotional items like the sleeves can be further described or photos available.
So the image that was presented was basically what the sleeve consisted of, although there was text on that as well. So we can talk with the public health unit to see if they'd be willing to share that.
Does anyone have any questions that they'd like to ask over the phone? I'm must have also covered your study very thoroughly, like Joel.
It was a lot of material.
And again, just as a reminder to participants, if you do have questions after the webinar, please feel free to contact Marit or any of the presenters today. Hi, this is Eric. I have a question. I'm wondering if the health unit considered using the channel of radio for any of their promotional campaigns.
They did, and they had actually developed radio ads, but unfortunately because of budgeting issues and the lack of resources that they encountered, they weren't able to run them. But something like that could have really improved the reach of the campaign. But again, it was this challenging factor of resourcing that was a real issue for the campaign.
One more question coming through. And I was just wondering if the radio ads can be shared with other health units?
So I would need to ask the public health unit about that as well.
Okay, I think if we don't have any more questions, we'll end a little early so everyone can get to their lunch a little bit earlier today. So I'd like to thank all of the presenters today. And as I've mentioned already, if you have additional questions, please feel free to contact them. It's important to note that everyone attending this webinar can expect to receive an email by the end of the day today that will contain a link to an evaluation survey. If everyone could kindly take a few moments to complete the evaluation, we appreciate it. Your input is important to help us improve the webinars and to host future learning opportunities to meet your needs. For those of you who would like to access the webinar recording, this will also be made available to you and details will be provided in a follow-up email. So again, I'd like to thank the presenters. If you'd like more information about OTRU, as Alexi has already provided, the website for OTRU is www.otru.org. And please feel free to contact the Program Training and Consultation Center if you'd like more information about our services and resources, or if your health unit or organization would like to host a PDCC training session. So I'd like to thank everyone who attended the webinar today, and I hope everyone has a great day. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please stand by.